Hi, this is Books and Arts on RN Summer. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Today, a show all about connections. Connections between art and expression, between two people on different sides of a debate, and connections between faraway places, which is where we're going to begin today with a much-loved American poet and teacher, Naomi Shihab Nye. Naomi's dad was Palestinian and her mum American. She grew up between the Midwest and the West Bank, and her poetry often works to make connections between places and between people that seem far beyond it. For Naomi Shihab Nye, poetry offers us a place to stand, to breathe out into our experience of the wider world. Naomi, welcome to Books and Arts.
Thank you. It's such an honor to be with you, Sarah.
Naomi, I think that at almost every Zen or meditation retreat I've ever been to, at some point, someone has read your poem, Kindness. Why do you think this work has had such an impact on people?
Well, you know, it's astonishing to me that a poem I actually feel I was only the secretary for. I feel as if this poem was spoken in the air and I copied it down. This has been the poem that travels the farthest. And what that says about poems and how they come to us when we need them or they have their own lives, I'm not sure. But I'm very grateful that so many people have found some comfort in this simple poem when they needed it.
And you say that it came to you. Where were you when this poem descended?
Well, I was in the town of Popayan, Colombia, in South America. And my husband and I, my new husband, we had just been married for 1 week at that time. We had been robbed of everything that we had with us on a bus. We were traveling in the night. We were headed south to the border of Ecuador. And it was a very, you know, challenging experience. Mm. And however, someone else who was on the bus was killed. So being in his presence and this trauma of what do you do next when this has happened and you're in a place where you have no friends, no family, no one to stand up for you, what do you do? And the next day in Popayan, this poem was spoken in the air across the town courtyard. That was a town, by the way, that soon afterwards would be devastated in a terrible earthquake. Mm. So that was haunting as well, looking back on it. A man came up and said something kind to us in the streets, sort of what happened to you in Spanish, and we tried to explain it, and he didn't do anything for us, but he listened. He tried to give us his empathy, and you know, when you look at the world these days and all the unkind things that seem to be happening everywhere, maybe this is a poem that's trying to be spoken again and again in the air, and I just happened to have a pencil and a notebook as the only things that had not been robbed, so I wrote it down.
Could you read it for us now, yes, please?
Kindness. Before you know what kindness really is, you must lose things, feel the future dissolve in a moment, like salt in a weakened broth. What you held in your hand, what you counted and carefully saved, this must go, so you know how desolate the landscape can be between the regions of kindness. How you ride and ride, thinking the bus will never stop. The passengers eating maize will stare out the window forever. Before you learn the tender gravity of kindness, you must travel where the Indian in a white poncho lies dead by the side of the road. You must see how this could be you. He too was someone who journeyed through the night with plans and the simple breath that kept him alive. Before you know kindness as the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing. You must wake up with sorrow. You must speak to it till your voice catches the thread of all sorrows and you see the size of the cloth. Then it is only kindness that makes sense anymore. Only kindness that ties your shoes and sends you out into the day to gaze at bread. Only kindness that raises its head from the crowd of the world to say, it is I you have been looking for. and then goes with you everywhere, like a shadow or a friend.
Naomi Shihab Nye reading her beautiful poem, Kindness. Naomi, one of the things that strikes me about that poem is when you were describing its writing, it came out of a really particular experience for you. I've never known that, but I think that as a listener, without that backstory, what you connect with is an expression of an experience that is universal of sorrow and of kindness, at both those sides of the human experience. It's such a beautiful testimonial to that, and a very unifying one, I find.
Oh, thank you for saying that, Sarah. And, you know, it reminds me of what I always believed about words and poetry, that they have power, that they have power to change a moment, to transform a mood of trauma or grief or lostness. Sometimes a simple phrase, a simple familiar strain of a song, a few words spoken, even overheard, could come along and rescue someone. And I think this has been one of the gifts of poetry through the years, and why so many people want to have poems present at significant moments of their lives. Mm.
Yeah. Exactly. It's there's not a wedding or a funeral without a poem. But
yes,
there's something sort of mysterious about that process, isn't it? Because sometimes you have the sense that a poem is giving you some kind of wisdom or insight, but sometimes it's more like the poem is just giving you space, giving you a room to feel something in.
Oh, that's so true. And last year I was working in Japan, and I learned from a student this Japanese word, yutori, which she said means life space. And she said there were many different interpretations for the meaning, things like arriving early somewhere so you don't have to rush, or giving yourself room to make a mistake. But then she went on to say that she had felt in our classroom that day that reading and writing poetry might give people the best consistent kind of yutori, life space, because she said it's where you stand back and you contemplate what you're living and experiencing. You look at your life, or you look at other people's lives, and there's a sense of gravity in that looking.
Mm. What a wonderful concept. And it's so beautifully Japanese that it can cover things like arriving at, you know, the train station
right.
plenty of time and appreciating a poem.
Yes,
it's a great
right.
culture.
It's very expansive. In fact, some boys said to me, when I asked them if that word meant anything to them in another class, they said, oh yeah, it's when your cord on your telephone has enough room to reach the plug when it's not taut. And I thought, yeah, there's even a tech definition for this word. I love it.
That reminds me of a beautiful line from a Yehuda Amakai poem about having a certain feeling of looseness inside, like when your shoelaces come undone. That idea of just a moment's relief, a breathing out, I guess.
That's so beautiful. And I don't know that line from him, but I'm a big Amakai fan. And I love his poems for the clarity of their images. And you feel as if your vision has just sort of resettled or sharpened when you read his poems.
Yes.
Yes.
And of course, he's a great poet of Jerusalem, which is a city that's important to you in your work.
Yes.
Tell us about your connection to that part of the Middle East, about where you grew up.
Well, my father was Palestinian, born in Jerusalem and grew up there and lived there till he was 21. His family became refugees in 1948. They lost their Jerusalem home and they moved to an ancient house in a village in the West Bank between Ramallah and Nablus. And my father was the only one of his brothers who knew from a young age that he intended to immigrate, or that he thought he would travel beyond the horizon, as he used to describe it. And he loved language. He worked for radio first, for the BBC. That was his first job, starting when he was 14. And then he went to the United States as a student and became a newspaper journalist. And his dream in life was to see the great city of Jerusalem become a peaceful place again, where all people were mutually respected and no one wielded power over the other residents or the other religions who, you know, had roots in that city. And so when I was a freshman in high school, my family moved to Jerusalem, hoping that this would be a time when things were growing calmer, but unfortunately they were not. So we stayed only a little more than a year, but it was a life-changing year. And my whole world, I would say, shifted in that year. I already was in love with poetry. I already knew that writing could be a kind of way of navigation through one's days. And being in a place where I didn't feel quite as if I belonged, and yet I was so attached to my family there and their traditions and my grandmother, who would live to be 106, it became really a central time of my life.
I want to know, Naomi, about you talk about the importance of going to Jerusalem and to the West Bank, of connecting with your family and that side of your culture. What about poetry as a kid? Were your parents readers of poetry? Was that something that you grew up with, or was that your own discovery?
Well, my mother, they were both lovers of language. I wouldn't say they were particular lovers of poetry, although my mother read poetry to me when I was a child, and they believed in just reading constantly. There were always books and papers and magazines in our house, and hearing poems read to me before I could read myself, mostly by my mother, and things like Langston Hughes or Emily Dickinson, you know, books we would get in the library. Robert Louis Stevenson of Scotland was an early favorite. I felt marked by that kind of language. I remember thinking, this is different. It's different from conversation. It's different from news. This is a language that describes, and then it sort of holds the image. It holds itself. It doesn't explain. It doesn't direct. It doesn't demand. But it holds beauty, and it holds perception in a way that I felt very hungry for, even being pre-literate myself. But then when I was able to write, I wanted to start trying to write poems. So my mother was a painter, more very connected to the world of visual art, and always taking us to museums and symphonies and teaching us music. And, you know, I think all of the arts feed us when we're children, but having parents who believed in language and story was very, very important to me. Our father would tell folk tales, Palestinian tales, and they helped him stay connected, I'm sure, to the world he had grown up in. And I really think of immigrants often as being doubly brave people. These days in the United States, I think immigrants are suffering from sort of a strange perspective about, know, kind of a what are you doing here perspective, which is very painful to me, because I look at immigrants as being doubly brave. They are able to navigate and live in more than one culture, more than one place. They have an expanded horizon, and we should honor that. And, you know, as human beings, I think we're always trying to be connected to a horizon bigger than, you know, our own needs, our own experience. You know, how can we expand? And I think poetry has always been one of the most intimate and immediate ways to do that.
And that connection with language and with poetry in particular is something you've passed on to your own son. I read that you used to wake him up when he was a kid by reading poetry at him.
I did. And I think he still appreciates that. He's now reading to his son, but I'm not sure if he'll be reading to wake him up. But a poet I've loved for so many years is Les Murray from Australia. And I know I would read Les Murray poems to him too. And I copied down a few lines. Like, I love this line from Murray: "Coming out of reflections, I find myself in the earth." You know, I love that I could read Les Murray poems and imagine what it was like to be raised on a dairy farm in New South Wales. Now, something I know nothing about, but I could feel close to it through his language.
Mm.
and his descriptiveness.
It's so beautiful to hear you reading his lines, Naomi, that they sound fresh again hearing them in your voice. But I suppose this is one of the interesting things, is that there's poetry like the phrases that you just read from Les Murray, which take us back to a childhood and an inner experience and an apprehension of the natural world. And then there's the poems like some of Yehuda Amakai's work or your own work, which look at suffering and much bigger political realities and history. How do you see poetry as doing both of those things? Or does poetry do something different for us when it's writing about war or the Middle East than when it's writing about iron bedspreads and the natural world?
Oh, that's such a beautiful question, Sarah. And you know, I think poetry has great breaths within it, and I think it's able to do many different things. I think poetry would be happier if it didn't have to inquire and look at things like war, because these things are not what any of us dream for our realm. You know, we all, I've had a line inside my mind since I was a child: war has no imagination. And I don't know where I got that. I don't know if I made it up, but it always seemed to me that, you know, when people resort to war, it's as if they haven't thought about all the wondrous things they might do together. And I think of poetry often as a place of inquiry as well as description. And I think when we come to things like war and trauma, trouble, that the job of a poem is often to shine many small lights on the questions we ask within those realms. You know, poetry can't solve these things. Poetry can't put it all into neat patterns again and say, well, this is how it's going to be soon. But certainly it can ask the compelling, gripping questions that we're longing to understand better. Could I read just a couple of lines from a great American poet, Jane Hirschfield?
Please do.
These are from a very recent poem of hers. The poem is called Spell to be Said Against Hatred. And these are just like five lines from the poem. Until each breath refuses they, those, them. Until cruelty bends to its work and sees suddenly I. Until the ache of the solitude inside the hands, the ribs, the ankles. Until the sound the mouse makes inside the mouth of the cat. Until by we mean I, them, you, the muskrat, the tiger, the hunger. Now, I feel in my fellow sister and brother American poets these days an enormous propulsion toward tenderness, trying to figure out what is going on in our country, in our society right now, that is causing there to be kind of a dissolution of so many things we hold dear, mutual respect being at the heart of them. And I look back, one of the great translators of Yehuda Amichai was Hannah Block, who just died a month ago. She was a dear friend of mine, and I loved her own poems as well as her translations. She and I were often asked to appear together in different venues because people would like to have, you know, say, a Jewish poet and a Palestinian together.
Sounds like the start of a joke.
Yeah, it was very, very wonderful to be such close friends with her. And the irony was, we never felt that we were two sides of anything. Mm. We were two women, two friends who firmly believed that people could do better than this, and that both Jews and Arabs would be so much happier if they found ways to share their multitudes of talents. And I think of a line from Hannah, from one of her own poems about childhood. She said, if we were so happy, why weren't we happy? And I think so many mysteries of the universe are contained within that line.
That's it. It's a fabulous line.
And it's fantastic.
And in those phrases, the lines that you read from Jane Hirschfield, there is maybe that sense that, that poems don't usually try to convince us of the rightness or wrongness of a particular case or a policy or a country. They tend to more often just ask us to open up something in our humanity. Exactly. It's hard to talk about this without sort of sounding sometimes like, well, these sentiments have become really debased, haven't they? Like in our common language, it's almost like poetry is a place where we can still talk about what do we share as people and that, that longing for safety and for our loved ones to be safe and to see the sun in the morning and have a warm place to lie down at night. These sort of very simple human truths. When just thinking about that what poetry does in terms of writing about politics. If I think about, you know, your poetry around the situation in the Middle East, which doesn't shy away from the this outrages and the injustices, but it doesn't argue for something beyond let us see people as people and let us see ourselves in people.
Yes. Oh, that's beautiful. Mm. Thank you so much. Mm. Thank you for saying that.
I know, Naomi, that you teach poetry a lot. How do you go about approaching teaching people to write poetry?
Well, you know, I think there's always been a desire in many poets who work with students of all ages to help them apprehend the riches that they already possess, the experiences they've had, the images, the memories, that within those riches, you could make, describe a scene, you could, you know, come up with a stanza, you could come up with a poem, that you don't have to look for something you didn't have, just look at what you already have. And so finding strategies with language, finding ways to put words together, you know, I've always tried to create an environment that is contagious in the sense that it's friendly, it contains examples of many voices. I've always tried to share both, you know, beloved major poets' voices with kids as well as the voices of other kids, you know, mixing it up, putting language in front of them. Mm-hmm. And that exposure to poetry, just talking about a line, is something that can really be compelling to students in if they feel a certain trust and belief that, you know, you're not testing them, you're not putting them on the spot, you're not going to laugh at anything they say, they really can't be wrong. So trying to create an environment in which they feel comfortable to explore with language. Last summer, I remember walking into a summer school classroom in a very tough neighborhood in my own town in Texas. And the kids, you know, it was a very hot day and the kids looked a little exhausted. And before an hour had passed, one of the toughest looking boys in the room had said, "You know, sometimes I just feel I am in love with a word like lyrical." And I thought, this is so great, because no one would look at that kid and think that he is going to say something like that. And then he said, his next phrase was, "Do you think that's okay?" And I was so moved, I almost started weeping. And I said, let's just all talk about words we're in love with. And we did that for about 10, 15 minutes in both Spanish and English. And it was like a love fest just for words. And imagine how easy it was then to encourage them to write using some of these beloved words, because we were all sharing, you know, which ones we sort of carried around in our secret pockets of our minds and said over and over to ourselves when we needed comfort. It was beautiful. Mm.
Well, when you describe that classroom, it's almost like your role there is just to allow that natural urge to play with words, to hold them, to kind of polish them like we would a stone, to allow that to just come forth.
Yes. Well, I think that's often what we have to do when we try to teach and encourage the writing of poetry. And so, of course, exposure to many other people's voices and talking about ways people have written, strategies of writing, ways you can approach a subject, sharing lots of work, talking about revision, And being very welcoming to whatever emerges. And, you know, after more than 40 years of traveling all over the world, all kinds of settings with poetry, I've never been to any place where something beautiful didn't happen. It always happens. And this seems like a miracle to me, because some of the settings I've been cast into have been very unusual and slightly difficult. Difficult. Say a cafeteria with 300 rowdy kids. And still, nevertheless, you could always find a way to bring poetry into the room and to suggest how much we have it of it at all times. Because I grew up in a house with a journalist father, and there were always newspapers everywhere, I feel that I've been quite triggered by news through my whole life as a writer. And so just last week, I worked on a poem after hearing some people in TV news talking about how beleaguered the United States State Department is these days, because there are so many vacancies all over the world that have not been filled, where diplomacy is not being emphasized the way we would prefer to see it. And so I found myself, you know, thinking about state departments, and just, I was writing a poem called "You Are Your Own State Department." And I could read the first stanza of that. "Every day I miss Japanese precision, trying to arrange things the way they would. Or the call to prayer at Sharjah, the large collective pause. Also, the shy strawberry vendor with rickety wooden cart, a single small light bulb pointed at a mound of berries in one of China's great cities before dawn. Forever I miss my Arab father's way with mint leaves floating in a cup of sugared tea, his delicate hands arranging rinsed figs on a plate. 'What have we here?' said the wolf in the children's story, stumbling upon people doing kind, small things." And the poem ends, it goes on, it's one of my longer poems I've ever written, it's actually three pages, but it ends with, "Meanwhile, secret diplomats are what we must be. As a girl in Qatar once assured me, each day slipping its blank visa into our hands." And this was a beautiful girl who said that she had read actually a novel of mine called Habibi. And she said, "I know what you were doing. I know what you were doing in that book. You were making the kids the true diplomats of the earth." And I said, "Well, I never thought of it that way, but I like it."
Naomi Shihabna, you said a moment ago, reflecting on teaching poetry, "I've never been to a place where something beautiful didn't happen." And I feel like that could almost be a line from one of your poems, and it's what you've shared with us today on Books and Arts. Thank you so much for coming to talk to us.
Thank you, Sarah. It's the greatest honor to talk with you.
Naomi Shihab Nye. I spoke with Naomi in August last year when she was in Australia for an imagination conference held at Uluru. Doesn't she just seem perfect for that? You can read a lot of Naomi's poetry online, including that very beautiful poem, Kindness, which she read for us at the beginning. Or, of course, you can go into your local independent bookstore and order all the Naomi Shihab Nye you can get your hands on. You're with Books and Arts on RN Summer. I'm Sarah Kanoski.
Jab tak is mohabbat ka.
That's Zayn Malik, British singer and ex-boy band star, and he's singing there in Urdu. When Randa Abdel Fattah was working on her PhD a few years ago, she was simultaneously writing her 11th book called When Michael Met Mina. Some people are just too capable for my liking. When Michael Met Mina is a young adult novel about two Year 11 students who meet on opposite sides of an anti-refugee rally. Michael's the son of Aussie Values Party members, while Mina, who came from Afghanistan to Australia with her mum as a refugee, wins a scholarship to Michael's private school. The book won the 2017 Victorian Premier's Literary Award Prize for Writing for Young Adults, as well as the People's Choice Award. Here's Randa Abdel Fattah speaking with Jennifer Wong at last year's Sydney Writers' Festival. They're in the western Sydney suburb of Parramatta.
What does it mean to talk about your book, When Michael Met Mina, in Parramatta?
It's amazing. Yesterday I had a session and I was speaking to schools that were mainly from the western suburbs. And, you know, the questions are different. And I really, really say that very sincerely, because I've spoken about my books, and particularly When Michael Met Mina, you know, in eastern suburbs and around Sydney. And the questions here were, so can you tell us, when we are the victims of racism, what should we do? How should I speak back to racism? You know, there was an affinity there. There was an experience, a lived experience that I feel was very, very different to the sort of things that matter to people who are living in other suburbs and other parts of Sydney, because of the way that we tend to frame the western suburbs of Sydney around issues of race and class. And so that really resonates with the students, I think.
So what do you say when someone asks you, you know, it's after a session, they put their hand up in front of all their peers, some of whom may have been the perpetrators of the actual racism. What's your response in a moment like that?
I tell them, I respond to them based on my own sort of experience and journey and learning journey, which is that when I first started to get involved in anti-racism work, particularly after September 11, it was a kind of activism based on speaking back to racism, defining myself against the racists, being apologetic, explanatory, trying to prove my humanity. And I've realized now that that is a very, it's not only not going to work, like strategically wrong, but it is dehumanizing, and it is also emotionally draining. The sort of emotional labor that you invest in always proving yourself to other people is the wrong way of living. It means that you have an identity that's completely carved in terms of resistance, and there's nothing left for yourself. And so I told them to be, you know, I was very upfront, and I said, you define who you are, don't speak back to racism, create spaces that are away from it so that your life isn't dominated by it, and don't be apologetic for who you are. You decide on your own terms who you are.
As someone who's done a PhD, you, not me, you've written, this is your 11th book, and it's a very funny book. When Michael Met Mina is a very funny book, and it would be interesting to know how you go about looking at some of the very dark news stories based on the field work that you've done. How does that translate into something that's funny for young people?
Yeah, because I mean, that's the irony and the paradox of life. We tend to think that if you have racism and misogyny and homophobia, for example, and ableism, that it's always going to be dark and evil. And we forget the irony of life is people's complexities and contradictions. And it's in those contradictions that I find the humour. And that the ugly sits beside the beautiful. And it's always harder for people to actually confront that. It's so easy for us to think of every racist as somebody who's got a Ku Klux Klan outfit on, or somebody who screams, go back to where you came from, on public transport. It's very easy for us to dismiss them as racist, and they are. What's harder is to dismiss people who are nice, people who are, you know, pleasant, who are kind, and who still have very racist views. And that's what I try to do with my books, is to try and actually look at those people, because it's harder to disavow yourselves of racism when somebody's nice. And, you know, sort of the I'm not racist, but, or the racism that's couched in very liberal language. But in terms of humour, I mean, it's very easy to find it. Like, I was interviewing people, and one guy was so against multiculturalism and Muslims, and just couldn't, he really, really felt very strongly that Australia needed to return to the white Australia policy. And then during the course of the conversation, revealed his wife is Japanese. I mean, you just can't write this stuff and make it up, you know. So these sorts of contradictions, I feel, you know, bring out the humour.
We feel such a sense of today's Australia in this book, and it's not every day that you can pick up a book to see your suburb name, the roads that you drive down, the bus routes that take you to school in a book. What books felt like home for you when you were growing up?
Not many, because I was one of those teenagers who, or even probably, you know, younger than that, who was just so obsessed with books from the UK and the US. And so for me, it was, you know, those are the books that I just read and absorbed, you know, Sweet Valley High, Babysitter's Club, you know, and it was reflected in my writing. All my writing always took place in the US or the UK. It was, you know, just, there was, my imaginative world was never Australia. It was very rare for me to pick up a book and see my world in that book. If it was a book in Australia, it was always set in the outback and just has no, you know, like absolutely no relevance to my own life. But I feel that now it's so different and it's so much more exciting because the YA scene in Australia is just so, so amazing.
We hear a lot about diversity in lots of different areas in Australia, one of them being YA. And why does it matter that we're not just talking about someone's culture in a book? Is that enough for diversity, or is, you know, there's a lot at play, isn't there, when we're talking about identity?
Yeah, definitely. And diversity is one of those words that I think it's great if it leads us to ask the tough questions. I don't want it to be used as sort of a tokenistic way of saying, let's just check a tick a checklist of sort of what we figure as diversity, and all the time it's centered around, you know, the heteronormative white center. That for me is not diversity. That's just people managing diverse others, and it's about really starting to think about questions of equality and what do we mean as mainstream and what do we see as exotic, you know, deviations from the mainstream, and to recognize that whiteness is a culture in itself, and we never think about it in that way. We always think that that is the universal. And likewise, sexuality, like, you know, there's so many things that we think of as just, you know, distractions from the norm. And I think that's the real questions around diversity. And one more thing which I think is really important in the YA scene and the literary scene in Australia is that we don't just talk about diversity without changing the actual structures of power that manage that diversity. So we need to see reviewers from more, you know, not just from white backgrounds. We need to see, you know, awards committees, we need to see the media, the people who are organizing festivals, the curators of art. That's when you really see change happening.
So when you were young and you didn't see yourself or Australian things in the books that you were reading, do you think that had a negative impact on you at all? I mean, you've ended up writing 11 books, you think a lot about the current issues of today. What's the difference now with a young person growing up to have all of these books available to them that maybe do feel more like it's about them?
Yeah, I keep reflecting on this because, you know, on the one hand, I still fell in love with those books, and that's the power of story. You know, it's more when I look at it, so when I intellectualize it now, it's more the fact that sort of a resentment about the fact that I, as a racialized person, have to constantly invest that energy into walking in other people's shoes, usually white shoes. And that now has effects on people's life opportunities and chances and way of thinking. I can understand how that has framed and structured everything around the world that we live in now. But as a young person, I didn't see it that way. The only thing that probably I did feel was when I was a teenager and I started to become, you know, being Muslim and Arab was no longer sort of a description, it was an accusation because of the Gulf War and 9/11. That's when I started to realize that the power of story to make change, and that's when I felt that yawning gap in literary fiction when it came to people of my sort of background.
It's interesting you talk about walking in other people's shoes, because that's exactly what you've had to do in When Michael Met Mina, to get into the shoes of people who hold views that are, you know, anti-refugee and what have you. So how did you do that? How was that experience for you? And was it easy for you to sympathise with people whose views are, I'm assuming, drastically different to your own?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, the whole issue of writers walking in other people's shoes and, you know, in the sort of aftermath of Lionel Shriver and cultural appropriation, I think the main issue is, are you as a writer appropriating somebody else's voice? Are you taking up space from a marginalised voice? Are you conscious of power, questions of power and agency? And if I can tick off, you know, be satisfied that I can speak to those questions, then I do feel comfortable writing from those points of view. And my field work with the PhD research was completely, like, my PhD was about Islamophobia from the point of view of the perpetrators. So I spent all that time, you know, getting into their heads, trying to understand it, and that's why I felt I was, you know, able to write from their point of view.
Knowing the innermost thoughts of people who are Islamophobics, is it difficult to keep going day to day, knowing the amount of hate that some people hold in their hearts?
No, and I tell you why. It's because when I first started the research, I got quite depressed because I felt I was listening to all of these, you know, people saying the most appalling things. And it was only as I started to read about sort of the scholarship around race and Islamophobia and history that I realized that if you see racism as an individual thing, first of all, you will never... Well, the main thing is that nothing's going to change, because ultimately it's about systems and structures, and it's about institutions and the weight of historical sort of... the legacy of race, the historical legacy of race. And so it's like looking at patriarchy. If I were to invest all my anger at patriarchy, at the guy who catcalls, you know, at a construction site, what on earth is that going to change? You fight patriarchy, you fight the systems of misogyny, and it's exactly the same with race. So it was a lot easier for me to sit with people. It didn't mean that they got away with, you know, it wasn't an excuse for them, but it meant that when it comes to the energy I invest into anti-racism, I take on the real power structures, and hopefully then that will filter to people on a day-to-day level.
Would you say there's much optimism when you're talking to young people? You spend quite a lot of time talking to young people, not just this week, but in general.
I don't know if I could say it's optimism, but I do feel that there's a lot more awareness about what's happening. I feel that they're a lot more mature than teenagers were when I was a teenager. They're a lot more worldly, and that's probably the impact of social media. And I feel that they just... It's also the fact of multiculture. So the way that politicians problematize multiculturalism is one thing, but the fact of multiculture is something that you cannot avoid in Australia, and it's that fact that is shaping their sort of interactions with other people and their exposure to different points of view. And I think that's probably the most optimistic thing that you can say about this moment in time.
Jennifer Wong speaking with Randa Abdel Fattah at last year's Sydney Writers Festival for RN's Books and Arts. And Rhonda's book, When Michael Met Mina, is published by Pan Macmillan Australia. I'm Sarah Kanoski, and you're with RN Summer. Now on Books and Arts, we're heading to an organisation called Arts Project Australia. It's housed in a beautifully renovated industrial building in the Melbourne suburb of Northcote. Michael Cathcart visited the studio last year to check out their exhibition called Girt by Sea. It's a busy place, chock-a-block with people focused on making art. Here's Michael speaking with Arts Project Australia director Sue Roth.
Hello, Michael.
Let's describe for the radio audience where we are.
We're upstairs in our studio, which is a huge space. It sort of has two separate bits to it, and we're standing in the specialty programs end, and this is where we do digital art, ceramics, printmaking, photography. But today, our artists are doing a special workshop with Meg Williams, and Meg might like to tell you what they're doing.
We're just doing a little exercise on tone. So I've got lots of white objects here that are lit by various lights, and the artists are painting them. We did a little bit of a talk about tone, and the artists are transcribing them into five tones of one colour.
So there are various bits of pottery and candlesticks and
That's
stuff,
right.
And you've lit them rather dramatically.
Yeah.
So this building is full of people working away at arts projects. What brings them all here? Why are they all under your roof?
They all love making art, is the basic presumption. Some come not really knowing what they want to do or how they want to do it, but we have a philosophy of doing what you want. If you want to come and paint red dots all day, every day, you can do that. But because it's a very creative studio environment, the red dot people tend to absorb what other people are doing. And we have people who've been coming to our studio for 25 to 30 years, as well as some who started just this year.
Right.
So it absorbs, the culture absorbs. And everyone here has some form of intellectual disability, is the only common link other than art.
Are they here because they're artists, or are they here because art is useful for helping them deal with whatever they're dealing with?
They're here because they're artists. We know art therapy is a very valid thing, but we don't subscribe to it here.
Talk to me some more about that.
This organisation's now 43 years old. So it was started by a very wise and forward-thinking woman back in the day whose daughter, her artwork had a lot of potential and merit, and she thought that people with disabilities should be able to have their work displayed and exhibited in a professional and dignified manner. That's where it started. 10 years later, someone said, let's start a studio, because the work they were getting from mostly institutions was on really bad quality materials. I think we got funding for 2 hours a week, and now we operate 6 days a week, and we have 150 artists that come through the building every week. And as I say, many have very established careers as artists. That's what we're all about. It's about artists' personal artistic development, and the gallery downstairs facilitates their career development.
So they come here, and what, they work with other artists, do they, who've got skill in training them?
They're called staff artists. We have artists and staff artists. That's the difference.
Now, we've come here to your marvellous operation because there's a show on.
Girt by Sea. And we have a show on pretty much all the time.
Right.
Yeah. This one will run for around 6 weeks. But this is a pretty special one because it's been curated by a group of our artists for the very first time. Affectionately known as the Northcote Penguins, of course. And they'd named themselves. They were formed 3 years ago, and they meet every Wednesday to explore contemporary art theory, art history, learn about critiquing their own work and other people's work, and this year working on curating their own show.
Well, let's find out about the premise of the show first. Suzanne Brown and Camille Hanna are here as artists who've been enabling this. So can the two of you explain to me what the premise of this show is?
Well, we've been looking at Australian art history throughout 2016. We've covered it with the guys, so by learning that, they really have recognised the influences perhaps in their work and in the rest of the studio. This proposal was brought about by the artists having an opportunity to see where they fit as artists within the history of Australian art and how it's affected their personal views, but also their own aesthetics, from colours through to themes.
So two of the Northcote Penguins are with us. They're Jordan Dimke and Mark Smith. Hi, guys.
Hi.
So, Jordan, let's have a look at your work. What have you got on the wall?
I painted horses riding in the mountains.
So tell me about what you've used here. Is this pastel you've used?
Yes, pastel. And it's a quick sketch drawing. I did it in half an hour, I think. Yes.
So you've got a lovely sense of the horses moving,
yeah,
from left to right across the canvas, a sense of them maybe even stampeding. And there's a lot of kind of excitement and energy around them.
Yeah. I think it's somewhere in the mountains. It's hard to tell.
Were you looking at pictures of horses when you drew them, or have you been looking at real horses?
Pictures of horses when I draw this.
And what do you reckon is the secret to getting a really good horse?
Time and patience.
And Mark, you're standing by. Mark, what work have you got here?
The title, Looking Up. So it's painted like as if you're lying on the floor of the forest, looking up towards the canopy, all these trees and trunks of trees are circling around you, looking up towards the sky.
Did you actually lie down on the ground and look up to do that one?
I didn't. That was actually off a photograph I found on the internet. But it's more just the idea of looking up a tree, so I thought, yeah, I'll do that. So I did that, yeah.
And how long have you been an artist?
Oh, about 16, 17 years.
The picture of the canopy has got a red dot alongside it on the wall. Does that mean someone's bought it?
It does, yes. That was pretty sought after, a bit of work. A lot of people were interested in that piece. Yeah, it was sold, actually sold by Ted Jordan's dad, which is, you know, a good thing.
And what have you used there? Is it watercolour you've used there?
Yeah, watercolour.
So there's a very strong sense of Australian iconography all around these walls. There are gum trees and there are kangaroos and there are animals and birds and there's Captain Cork.
The whole exhibition, is called Go By Sea. And this wall that the sign Go By Sea is on starts and on from the left, like the colonial Captain Cook and the Endeavour. Then that's the right of that is the right of that is a map of Australia. To the right of that is the colonial picture, and then to the right of that is like the Sydney Harbour and the Opera House. Sort of, it's a chronological order kind of thing.
It all makes sense. Yeah, there's a kind of story unfolding as you move across the.
That could be one story. There's many stories. You could look at it that way, or you could look at each individual painting by themselves. Like really, it has lots of meanings. The whole exhibition, yeah.
So what's unusual about this exhibition is that it has been curated by the artists themselves. So how did you artists go about curating it? How did you make the decisions about how the work would be hung, which works you'd choose?
We wanted four categories, birds and plants, landscape and abstract and icon. And we knew about some artists like Peter Kay's artwork is a lot of like the Heidelberg School.
So we're looking at one of his pictures now, which is of a river rolling through summer hills. They're yellow with summer, and then the gum trees are there characteristically green under the Aussie blue sky.
It's extremely reminiscent of the Heidelberg view of Australian landscape. When we looked at all the artists over all the characteristics of all the artwork done in Australia over history, we realised that they all sort of fell into the funnel of these four headings, what Jordan just said. Like this wall is for landscape, and that wall is iconic, and the far wall is flora and fauna, and that wall, and the next wall is what's the other wall?
Abstract.
So on one wall, there's a series of iconic images that you could say are Australian. So there's the Garn, there is Ned Kelly, a reference to the famous Barmaid picture by John Brack. What's that one there?
Heidi, John and Sunday Reid.
Oh, John and Sunday Reid, they're iconic.
Yeah.
And there's a footy match, a couple of footballers there. What was the best thing about this project for you?
To learn about Australian art history.
The curation of this style exhibition will widen our knowledge, our inquisitive minds. When we see the next exhibition, it'll make us think. It'll come into the exhibition with curatorial eyesight. I looked up the word zeitgeist, and zeitgeist means the mood or spirit of the time. We may not be able to pinpoint direct influences into our work, but we can. Because we've grown up in Australia, Australia has been shaped by the times, by the zeitgeist, the mood of the times, and therefore you can say we have been, our work is influenced by history in that way. Yeah.
Artist Mark Smith, and before him Jordan Dimke. They're both Northcote Penguins. And you also met staff artists Meg Williams, Suzanne Brown, and Camille Hannah, along with the director of Arts Project Australia, Sue Roth. And the show they were discussing was called Girt by Sea, and it's no longer on, but there's always something interesting happening at the Gallery of Art Project Australia in Melbourne's Northcote. All the details are at the Books and Arts website if you head along to abc.net.au/rn. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks so much for your company as we bring you some of the highlights from the last year on Books and Arts. I hope you're enjoying your summer and particularly your RN summer. I'll check you later.